Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Paul Lawrence, a partner at PricewaterhouseCoopers and the co-chair of the Endowment for the Business of Government. We created the Endowment in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. To find out more about the Endowment, visit us on the web at endowment.pwcglobal.com. We have a special show today. Today we'll discuss the use of faith-based organizations to provide services, which is the mission of the Bush administration's new Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives. We'll be speaking with experts in the faith-based social service delivery programs to find out what this is and how they operate. Our first guest is Dr. John Bartkowski. He's currently an assistant professor of sociology at the Department of Sociology, Anthropology, and Social Work at Mississippi State University. Dr. Bartkowski is the author of a study of faith-based welfare reform in Mississippi and has done research on the impact of community activism in Austin, Texas. He is also the co-author of a book under review on charitable choice called Faith, Hope, and Charitable Choice. His research interest is the nexus between religious involvement, social inequity, and family life. In 1999, the PricewaterhouseCoopers Endowment for the Business of Government funded a study of faith-based welfare reform in Mississippi, which you co-wrote with Dr. Helen Regis. Could you summarize your study's findings?
Sure, I could. First of all, I guess I'll say that we spent time interviewing pastors in Mississippi and then spent time in congregations actually observing the type of relief practices that congregations engaged in. And really, a couple of key findings emerged from the study. First of all, we found that local faith communities employed a number of different strategies for providing aid to local poor populations. The first one we called intensive and sustained engagement with the poor. And basically, intensive engagement entails sustained face-to-face contact between congregants that are providing relief and poor populations that are receiving relief through local faith communities. Very often, this is done by congregations that are situated in poor areas and that count poor families among their members. So this is a very, very powerful form of aid provision that a number of congregations provided. And the second one was what we called direct intermittent relief to the poor. Direct intermittent relief entailed some type of direct face-to-face contact between the aid-giving congregation and the aid recipient, say a poor family, for example. Direct intermittent relief, however, was typically infrequent. So many of us are familiar with during the winter holiday season, Christmas season, Hanukkah, congregations will get together and provide like food baskets or other sorts of gift giving that goes on around that time of the year. And that's a good example of direct intermittent relief to the poor. So it's infrequent. There is typically some face-to-face contact, however, between congregants and the recipients of faith-based aid. The third strategy that congregations here utilized is a parachurch collaboration. So sometimes congregations will get together and they will pool their resources. They will set up an agency, say maybe down the street from each of them, that'll be housed in a particular office where when people come and knock on their door and ask, you know, do you have some food or can you pay my utility bill for me this month? I'm running a little short. Some congregations will send their aid solicitors down to some type of central office. And some pastors like this strategy because they feel like they can provide aid more readily to the poor if they have limited resources. Pooling their resources can be useful. One of the drawbacks, of course, of that aid provision strategy in compared with the others is that both intensive engagement and indirect or the direct intermittent relief entail some type of face-to-face contact with the poor. The parachurch strategy, however, pulls basically poor people out of the lobbies and the offices in local congregations and puts them in some type of, you know, agency, kind of semi-bureaucratic agency even. So it really promotes social distance between poor recipients of church aid or faith-based aid and the congregational providers of relief.
Can you give us an update on the situation in Mississippi today?
Sure. What's happening in Mississippi is actually a little bit hard to keep one's finger on the pulse of because Mississippi started actually even prior to welfare reform legislation, you know, that actually was used to pass charitable choice. But before welfare reform came about federally, Mississippi led the nation in its Faith and Families of Mississippi program by trying to pair up adoptive congregations with needy families. Mississippi is showing some indications of continuing to provide some type of support to faith-based organizations. There's a fatherhood initiative recently that I've read about, and so basically they're providing some funds in that direction. But it's been very, very difficult to tell exactly what Mississippi and even a number of other states throughout the U.S. are doing regarding charitable choice. Actually, the Center for Public Justice has engaged in a tracking report study on charitable choice implementation, and they're an organization that really tries to basically maintain open communication between states that are interested in implementing charitable choice to help them kind of pool and exchange ideas. And they actually gave Mississippi a failing grade for failing to provide sufficient information about what they're doing regarding charitable choice. It seems that a number of states are interpreting charitable choice as meaning that states have the choice about whether participating in the program or not, and that's clearly not the intention. Charitable choice is a law that essentially says that state providers of aid, when they put out requests for proposals, cannot discriminate against religious organizations on the basis of their faith. So it's not an optional program for states, but some states are interpreting it as something that's optional that they can choose to be part of or not. And actually, the Center for Public Justice is trying to re-educate states in that direction to say that this is a mandatory program. And if you're contracting out services, you cannot exclude faith-based service providers as potential potential providers of relief.
Have you followed the Bush administration's faith-based initiative?
I sure have, yes.
And could you describe what that is to us?
Yeah, essentially, I mean, as I understand it, the Bush administration is not providing additional money to provide extra services through faith-based organizations, but it's trying to provide a federal structure, I think partly to educate states and also to help facilitate implementation of charitable choice. So basically, I mean, it's trying to set up a structure whereby states with questions about charitable choice implementation will know where they can go in order to do this. Prior to this point, the Center for Public Justice, a couple of other agencies, but primarily them, have seen themselves as educators of states. But of course, that's too large of a task for any nonprofit agency by itself to undertake. So as I see it, the Bush administration is trying to set up a structure whereby states can feel like they will have assistance in implementing charitable choice locally.
What impact do you think this will have on the delivery of human services across the country?
Well, I'm a sociologist, so I think social structures like organizations such as the Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives are going to probably have a pretty profound impact on faith-based service delivery and, I guess, service delivery in general. Basically, I think that this is going to help address a lot of questions that some state policymakers may have, and they could probably position themselves as educators of states when called with questions or even kind of circulating memoranda to try to make sure that states are understanding precisely what charitable choice entails.
What type of impact do you think it will have in terms of what kind of criteria?
Actually, the criteria are spelled out in charitable choice legislation. So actually, let me just say there's two dimensions of choice in charitable choice law. One is the notion of giving faith-based providers the choice of competing for purchase of service contracts with the government. So previously, religious providers of social services had to strip away all kinds of religious imagery, icons, language from their service provision efforts in order to compete for and receive public monies. Charitable choice kind of undoes that stipulation. So what charitable choice does is give faith-based providers the chance to kind of claim and retain their faith while competing for public monies. Then the second side of choice is that any type of recipient, a TANF client, for example, of public money cannot be forced to accept services from a faith-based provider. So you have kind of religious freedom for faith-based providers to pursue public monies, and you're also supposed to have the religious liberties protected of the TANF or Temporary Assistance for Needy Families recipient.
I'm talking with John Bartkowski, professor of sociology at Mississippi State. This is the Business of Government Hour. We'll rejoin our conversation on faith-based initiatives in just a minute.